This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
On the retirement of Justice John Paul Stevens, we'll look at the myth and reality of his legacy, possible nominees to replace him, and the current and seemingly continuing drift to the right of the U.S. Supreme Court.
And whether the Obama administration is likely to or can move beyond appeasement of the center-right with Ted Shaw, former director, counsel, and president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, where he litigated civil rights cases at the U.S. Supreme Court, and among other positions, Ted was a former trial attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice.
Good to be back with you.
You know, one of the questions I have, I guess the right has been somewhat better in this diatribe or rhetoric than the left has, but there's been this presumption that it is liberals, if you will, who are activists, who create a context for courts to be ideologues and to act on it. In conjunction with this, how do you look at the work of and the justices of the Supreme Court in, let's say, just the last 10 to 15 years? Is it the liberals who are the activists, or do we have an activist Supreme Court who isn't liberal?
The term activist is one that is used, as you correctly point out, to describe what liberals do. Truth is that there have been few liberals. They've been few and far between on the Supreme Court and also in the lower federal courts for quite some time. And whether one is engaged in judicial activism really depends on whose ox is being gored. When you talk about the Supreme Court decision in 2000 reaching out to decide the disputed presidential election, that was activism. The court didn't have to decide that case. There was a constitutional structure for dealing with that exigency, and the court, or at least five members of the court, reached out to decide it on a theory of the 14th Amendment that never existed before and the court says should never be applied again. That was activism. When the court decided the parents' involved case involving voluntary integration of public schools, I think the court went further than it needed to go. That's activism in the way it decided that opinion. And this term, the court decided the Citizens United case involving the question of whether or not, corporate speech in the form of an anti-Hillary Clinton film that was being advertised during an election campaign, during the primary season, could be regulated and restricted. And the court said no, and in doing so overturned a lot of judicial precedent. That was activism. And so it's very clear that we have a conservative activist court that's in place right now. And it's a court that, I think is moving the country, continues to move the country further and further to the right.
One of the things I've always, I'm certainly interested in your opinion and thoughts on the matter, and that is between the media, who is proclaimed within the prominent culture of the society to be presumed to be neutral. The media should be neutral. We understand full well that there are extremes within that, with the shock jocks, etc., but the news is supposed to be neutral. Courts are supposed to be neutral, just operate by stare decisis. One decision follows on the next. What do you actually think about the reality and what the Supreme Court should be in its adjudication of cases that are critical to the lives of all people in this country?
Well, the notion that anybody is purely objective is one that I've always found to be, untenable. We all bring to whatever endeavor we're engaged in the sum total of all our experiences and who and what we are. I think judges are commanded to try their best to set aside their personal prejudices and biases, and to decide cases based upon the law, applied to the facts. Sometimes judges do better than that at that than other times. But that's the ideal that we're taught in law school. As a practical matter, we have a judiciary now that when it comes to controversial issues, whether we're talking about civil rights, gender, race, or sexual orientation, or whether we're talking about issues like a woman's ability to control her own body, reproductive rights, whether we're talking about civil liberties in the context of post 9/11 restrictions on people who are Muslims or from the Middle East, or people who've been brought to Guantanamo Bay from other countries and charged with terrorism. In all those instances, and in many more instances, often, too often these days, I think that one can tell what the likely result is going to be, depending on, what the assignment of a judge is, or in the Court of Appeals, what the draw of an appellate panel is. And in the Supreme Court, of course, once the issue gets to these nine justices, very often, it's more likely to go one way than another way. And if it's in question, you know that the likely vote that you have to get to determine it, the swing vote, is Justice Kennedy these days. Before that, it was Justice O'Connor. So, unfortunately, we have a court that is ideologically split, tilted very heavily toward the right, with a right, a center, and no real left.
That's what I wanted to pursue in terms of the left. It's, a lot of people say, oh, there are four liberals, there are four conservatives, and one middle of the road. How would you characterize the court, and how would you characterize the decisions of departing Justice John Paul Stevens?
Well, Justice John Paul Stevens is the most liberal justice on the current Supreme Court. But that's so because, it's all relative. Certainly Justice Stevens has moved more to the liberal side of the court in his years on, that he's been there. He was appointed by President Ford. He was more conservative then. And over the years, two things has happened, one more than the other. One thing is that, yes, Justice John Paul Stevens has moved more to the left. But more than that, the court has moved around him toward the right, and he has said that. And so his liberalism is real, but it's relative. When we talk about Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, and now Justice Sotomayor, those are justices who are really very centrist. During the nomination proceedings for Justice Sotomayor last year, the Republicans, the conservatives, did their best to paint her as a liberal activist and somebody who was outside of the mainstream. What that was really about, I think, more than anything else, was the next nomination, this nomination, and subsequent ones, and nominations to the lower federal court, trying to define who's acceptable and who isn't. So we really have centrists on the court who are liberal by comparison to the other justices, and Justice Stevens, who has become the most liberal justice on this court.
One of the things we should look at is the whole question of the process of confirmation. And what I was thinking about in relationship to that, I still remember an article in the Detroit Free Press in October, roughly, where, of course, President Obama praised Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan of the Warren Court as real, quote-unquote, heroes of mine, but then immediately added that he didn't think their judicial philosophy was appropriate for today, which kind of pains me to the quick in many ways. But aside from looking at where Obama is bound, the nature of the confirmation process, which we saw with Sotomayor, we saw the pillorying of Lonnie Guinier. What do we learn from, or what's the substance of that process? And does there need to be a real reformation of the confirmation process?
Well, I think many observers would say that there needs to be some reformation, but nobody knows quite what to do. What we've learned about this process, and there's some coverage about this these days as we move toward a nomination by President Obama. There are people who are observing correctly that the conservatives, the Republicans when they were in office, that the court, the Supreme Court in particular, but the courts in general, the federal courts, are among their priorities. They know that that's their legacy more than anything else. Long after they've left office, they can have reach into the present by determining who goes on the court. And somehow or another, they get that, but Democratic presidents don't really get that as well. And Republicans are unapologetic about nominating to the court strong conservative Republicans who are going to be people who carry out their agendas. On the other side, you know, it seems to be the case that for whatever reason, that's not true of Democrats when they're in office. They are thinking about how to appoint people who are not going to be as objectionable to conservatives. In part, this is true because I believe that the Republicans have been able to march in something close to lockstep in the past, but now they're marching in lockstep. And when Democrats are in, they are not all in lockstep or agreement. You have some Democrats who are very conservative. And so if you have President Obama and it turns out if he is unwilling among his nominees to put someone on the court in the tradition of Justices Brennan and Marshall, whom he said he respected and admired, and I don't doubt that, then I think that it's going to be tough to see, you know, any president putting on people in that mold. And I think that's a shame because I think we have a court right now that doesn't have representation of a real liberal wing.
Well, I thought it was only 50% that he needed in the Senate. So does he really need to worry about what the Republicans think?
Well, you know, the concern is filibuster. And whether or not the Republicans are going to mount a filibuster. So, yes, he needs to get, you know, a majority for confirmation purposes. But if there's a filibuster, then, you know, that's another scenario. So I think that's the concern. Now, one of the concerns that I've had is that ever since, you know, the Democrats lost their bulletproof supermajority, some of them have been acting as if they now don't have a majority at all. That would be a shame. They still have a majority, and if Republicans are going to filibuster in some instance, I think they have to go ahead and say, go ahead, filibuster. You know, we're going to have to take you on this. If they don't do that, what they've done is effectively surrendered their majority status.
Now, I know that President Obama really faces a vastly altered political landscape from the one he faced just 11 months ago. But what I see or I fear is the enshrining, really, of the 5-4 vote of the court if one, for example, just replaces a liberal with a liberal. And thus the vitality and the very function of the court seems to me to be static and not really living up to its function as defined by the Constitution.
Well, we all know that this nomination is not going to alter the balance of the court. It can do one of two things. It can either maintain the balance of the court, that is to say, you know, 5-4 as you talked about, or it can move the court further toward the right. If Justice Stevens, who's the most liberal member of this court, is replaced by somebody more conservative, then effectively, even if that person is not a quote, conservative, end quote, per se, it will effectively move the court further to the right. That's why I think it's so important that this nominee be somebody who keeps that tradition, that liberal tradition alive in the court, because the court needs to have a discourse in which that voice or those voices are present. Given the direction of the court in recent years, it's been moving in a way that is abandoning that tradition and that discourse.
What's at stake here? What are some of the issues that the Supreme Court will be deciding, say, in the next year, that make this so important that we get a good person on the Supreme Court?
Well, the court's going to continue to have cases coming to it which raise questions about how we handle or continue to handle civil liberties issues. This so-called war on terror is still the backdrop of some of the most contentious issues that are coming to the court. We're also going to continue to see the issues of choice at times pushed to the court. Everybody has a consciousness of the same-sex marriage issue these days. That's going to be in play in the political arena, but also will find its way into the judicial arena. The Supreme Court decided the case involving whether colleges and universities could engage in conscious attempts to enroll students of color. You know, the Michigan case a few years ago, I think there is probably a pretty broad consensus that if that issue were to return to the court these days, that the result might be different unless the court did, in fact, feel constrained by stare decisis rather to follow its precedent. Those issues will continue to come to the court and many others. The question of gun control, came to the court, recently in Heller, the Washington, D.C. case. But now we have the issue returning to the courts in another context, and the court's going to decide another gun control case this term. That issue will come back to the court, I'm sure, from other jurisdictions. What are the contours of what the federal and state governments and local governments can do to control the spread of firearms and violence in our cities and other communities? So, the most controversial issues come to the Supreme Court, where the political process can't abandon them. Of course, constitutional issues come to the court because the court's the final arbiter, although not the sole enforcer of the Constitution. So, these issues will continue to come to the court, and they're going to be tremendously important. And it's a mistake for the public to underestimate how important the Supreme Court is. Think, again, Bush v. Gore, if you think the court isn't important.
I keep going back in my mind to not only the resignation, which is imminent, of John Paul Stevens, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg being replaced, and again, the maintenance at best of status quo, which seems to be the direction that President Obama is headed in. And there's really almost a creation of a very narrow elite that's been imposing itself through the legal system. And, well, it's my own perspective that we need to start asserting ourselves. And names that I've heard floated, but really very much in the background, certainly are not any proliferation of African-American names. There was some mention of Eric Holder and Governor Deval Patrick. But even people like Kathleen Sullivan, who is perhaps more liberal than a number of the names we've heard, really seems to be pushed to the background. So, what do we say about that? Is it just a matter of, again, being a pragmatist in a society that has an aggressive right-wing streak to it?
Well, we are a society that has...
And, of course, there's the gun demonstration in Washington, Second Amendment.
Right, the Second Amendment. I mean, there's an example of judicial activism. Again, I mentioned the Heller case, but, for a couple of hundred years, the Second Amendment was interpreted in the context of its language, which talked about the right to bear arms, as part of a militia. And the Supreme Court decided that individuals have the right to bear arms outside of that context, even though there was established case law that said otherwise. That's judicial activism. And now you have folks coming to Washington, and in a frightening way, I guess it was in the West, or Midwest, I think it was in Denver, not long ago, where people showed up at a rally at which the president was speaking, armed with guns because they could. That's pretty frightening, in my view. So, yes, there's an aggressive, right wing in this country. There's an irrational element of hatred for the president and this administration. People who believe in a wild and radical way that he's a Muslim, he's lying about his faith and who he is, and whether he's trying to make the country into something that it is not, whether he's a socialist and all of that. So, this is a time in which rhetoric is dangerous, and it's so important for the courts, ideally, to play a role in being level-headed and not engaging in activism. We have yet to see how the court is going to treat some of these issues, but we have strong reason for concern. My view, as I've indicated already, is that this is a court that's become, everybody agrees, this is a court that has become more and more conservative. It's a court that is impoverished, I think, in terms of its internal discourse as a consequence. I think this is a time for this president and this administration to put somebody on the court who is, in fact, a liberal, and to be unapologetic about it, to balance the court in a way that can only be done if the president does what Republicans do, and that's to be unabashed about nominating somebody who has liberal values, and the president needs to say that this isn't outside the mainstream at all. Thurgood Marshall could not be appointed to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Couldn't be confirmed. Wouldn't be appointed. And that says a whole lot, given who he was and what he accomplished and how he contributed to this country.
And I keep thinking about replacing Ginsburg, finally, and Stevens with some bold progressive or two so that things might seriously change. A really powerful, articulate, and moral, passionate voice on the left, which might change the dynamic of the court and bring those justices who might be inclined to be sympathetic to that voice in the direction of the left. But
the sad thing is that you say that, and I suspect that most people listening, and certainly those who are observant of the court and who know the politics of the time, say, yeah, fat chance. You just don't see that happening these days. But why shouldn't it happen? Why can't it happen? Shouldn't there be somebody? See, people who are in the tradition of Brennan and Marshall are people who are, in fact, very much American. They're being defined as un-American. It's shameful what the right wing has been able to do and when they take on this arrogance to define who's in the mainstream and who's American and who isn't. Brennan and Marshall contributed a great deal to this country. And to say that somebody in their mold cannot be appointed to the Supreme Court or confirmed these days is a terrifically sad statement. But it also leaves the court, and I keep coming back to this point, tremendously impoverished in terms of its own internal discourse. If all you get is conservatives, and with all due respect, and I do respect them and support them, centrists talking to each other on the court. That's an impoverished discourse.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We will definitely invite you back to begin to maybe play some of the guessing game and look at some of the nominees as the process unfolds in this very critical venue. Ted Shaw, one of the leading voices for civil rights in this country. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
It's a new day. Till now, corporations influence politics with high-paid lobbyists and backroom deals. However, as much as corporate interests gave to politicians, we could never be absolutely sure they would do our bidding. But today, thanks to an enlightened Supreme Court, Corporations now have all the rights the Founding Fathers meant for us. It's our democracy. We bought it, we paid for it, and we're going to keep it. That's why Murray Hill Incorporated is taking democracy's next step, running for Congress. The way we see it, corporate America has been the driving force behind Congress for years, but now it's time we got behind the wheel ourselves. Murray Hill Incorporated will bring enlightened self-interest and corporate accounting to government to put business first. It is a vision for the future we can all be proud of. Now that democracy is truly for sale, Murray Hill Incorporated is offering top dollar. Vote Murray Hill Incorporated for Congress for the best democracy money can buy.
I'm Eric Hensel, designated human for Murray Hill Incorporated. We approve this message.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.